This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello, welcome to my very first podcast to celebrate 20 years of LDI in the UK. I'm Amandeep Nagra, co-head of strategic clients here at Elgin, and I'm delighted to be joined by two well-known, experienced DB practitioners. Firstly, really pleased to be joined by Steve Jones, head of pensions at Boots to Get the Client View. Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Thanks, Amandeep. Delighted to take part.
And secondly, to provide the consultant lens, we are joined by Tim Giles, senior investment partner and EMEA managing director at Aon. Tim, welcome. Thank you for joining.
Amandeep, delighted to be here and delighted to have been on this journey with Boots.
Thanks, guys. So LDI has come a long way since we implemented an LDI strategy on behalf of the Boots pension scheme 20 years ago. In fact, it's changed a huge amount in the last 8 years during my time at Elgin alone, and it's going to continue to evolve and change from here. Steve, I was going to start with a question for you. I know you are still relatively new to Boots, but certainly no stranger when it comes to working with big pension funds in the UK. From an Elgin perspective, we've seen a shift over time of clients and consultants wanting to understand and direct the nitty-gritty within an LDI portfolio, to nowadays providing a much greater level of delegation to their LDI providers, Elgin in our case, and really focus on the bigger decisions around the level of hedging and broader considerations on collateral adequacy. From a client perspective, would you make the same observation? And what does this look like from the client side?
No, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, trustee time is relatively short. You know, they don't have the time or the bandwidth to really focus on the nitty-gritty. Really just keen to know that their investment managers are doing what we expect them to do. I mean, what I've seen, the way it's worked from a client side, is clearly the trustees are very keen to understand how the LDI managers operate and what they do. But once they've got their head around, it's really up to the managers, and with, you know, direction from the likes of Tim to make sure that they're doing what they say they're doing and achieving the objectives, you know, that they want to achieve. I mean, it's a very much drawn a comparison to, you know, an active equity manager. You know, when you're selecting that manager, you're keen to know what their processes are, but once you've selected them, you let them get on and do it. You don't necessarily interfere with how they select their stocks. And it's very same, you know, that mindset translates to the LDI managers as well.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's certainly, yeah, how I think it works best. Trustees focusing really on the much bigger decisions and actually allowing their manager to try and get on and do the right thing in terms of building and managing that portfolio. Tim, I suspect a similar view from yourself, but interested to get your take on this. In particular, I would be really interested to hear about your journey in advising clients to hedge as rates continued to trend lower over the last 20 years, and the pushback I suspect you received from clients questioning whether to wait for eventually, as I've heard on many occasions, mean revert, which they certainly haven't yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think firstly, sort of picking up on some of the themes that Steve said, is LDI on first blush seems to be very, very complicated. I think as trustees and everybody involved has seen the fact that it removes the volatility that the liabilities can sometimes cause in the funding position, everyone's got more comfortable with it. So as you see the results and the outcomes, the underlying complexity, then people are less worried about and they sort of focus on that. Yes, initially when people were on the journey, they were thinking, crikey, bond prices are historically high, and then they only got higher after that point in time, and people were resistant for buying LDI. But I think it's actually, Steve said something recently sort of in one of our meetings, he says, you meet few trustees who regret buying LDI. So I think ultimately every pension scheme sort of that has a limited life is on this journey to probably buying some form of LDI, be it in their own form of self-sufficiency or be it as part of an insurance product. Therefore, you've got to buy it at some price, and the price might look high historically, it might look higher in the future, but you've got to buy it at some price. And when you can afford it and when you can buy it and when you see it de-risking your pension scheme, most trustees get happy with that and increasingly happy about it. So the argument has now moved away from the absolute price to more sort of, I would like to remove the risk and I will do it when I can afford to do so with the assets I've got.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. I think looking back at the early stages of LDI, the decision to hedge or not to hedge was often viewed as a market view rather than a decision versus your liabilities to reduce risk. It was trying to take a view on whether or not now was the right time. And given rates have been falling throughout my time in pensions, it was always this sense of, well, surely they have to bounce back at some point. But actually putting trustees on the spot at any given point in time and asking them, where do you think next for gilt yields? Actually, none of them would necessarily have a very strong level of conviction, but were still, I think, you know, previously in any case, very much taking the decision to remain exposed to that risk. I think that's been, as you said, as people have got more comfortable and as trustees have got more experience of seeing how LDI can actually protect the funding position and smoothen that journey, that's, you know, that's taken away, I guess, the idea of trying to time the market in that sense, but actually just take sensible strategic decisions around what their level of appetite is for funding level volatility. So no, that definitely chimes. I was going to move on and actually try and look ahead. So Steve, I was going to ask you a question with a forward-looking lens. What are you thinking about next from a de-risking liability hedging perspective?
Okay, I mean, I think there's a lot's changed over the last sort of 20 years generally in looking at DB pension schemes, in that, you know, with most schemes now closed and now a legacy issue rather than the main method of providing pensions for companies' employees, I think everyone's now looking at the end game. How do we, where do we end up with these pension schemes? And I think what's interesting is that where you think your scheme is going to end up really determines what your LDI strategy is now, really, and going forward. You know, so for, I know many schemes now will be looking at buyout as the ultimate destination. You know, so you really should then be thinking about, okay, how do I get there? What steps do I need to take? What plumbing needs to be put in place today, you know, to help smooth that journey get there, you know? And you need to think about whether a series of buy-ins, because, you know, the buy-in market might move differently to your asset mix and your liability profile, so you can try and take advantage of opportunities when they arise. Or the alternative is, you know, to try and sweat your growth assets and do it in a big bang at the end. It's trying to work through and understand how you're going to get to that end game, I think, and it'll be a different path depending on where you think that might be. And I think it'd be interesting looking at if your liability then becomes a buyout in 10 years' time, for example, that has different characteristics to if you are just managing a series of cash flows over the next 50 years. So you need to make sure that your LDI strategy is consistent with that, and you're not blindly following the 50-year cash flow model, thinking that's fit for purpose when you've got a different end game in mind.
Yep. Steve, you touch on an area which is obviously very close to our hearts here at L&G. The challenge for all LDI providers and all de-risking providers is around how we can best support clients on that journey to your respective end games. Because like you say, each scheme is going to be a bit different. Each scheme is going to have a different starting point and potentially a different objective as well. And so I think what we expect to see is a huge amount of innovation still yet to come, actually, on that journey. You touch on, you know, being ready for buy-in transactions, if that's your objective. And we certainly see innovation around that area, around trying to put in place infrastructure, I think, as you said, to make that as easy as possible client, and take advantage of market opportunities, frankly, as they present themselves. As you said, you know, a client, the buy-in pricing is likely to move differently to the performance of your investment portfolio. And actually, it's those mismatches that in themselves can present quite a lot of opportunity. So, I mean, Tim, linked to this is the role of credit in client portfolios. Credit provides a hedge. It provides a higher return relative to gilts. It helps deliver cash flows to pay pensions. And we just talked about, you know, the correlation to buy-in pricing, which we know has a substantial credit component to it. As credit portfolios take up a bigger proportion of client portfolios, how should clients be thinking about incorporating both public and private debt into their kind of de-risking LDI portfolios?
The great thing is you sort of remove one risk, you find another underlying risk, and then another underlying risk. So at each stage, you're trying to move a reasonable portion of the risk and then keep going. A lot of trustees are on that journey and seeing the end point as being insurance, buy in to buy out some form of insurance. So, and the other one is we're going to run the pension scheme on. We're going to get a form of assets to sort of deliver cash flows, and they'll meet for pensions. And the intuitive benefit of that sounds great. So I've got pensions to pay, I'll get assets which are cash generating, they'll pay the benefits, and we'll go on like that, and that will solve the problem. That's how we'll finish things. That is great. That works. And it, to your point as well, Amadeep, it ties in with, there is a credit element to that pricing of those insurance contracts if you want to. But the insurance contracts, ultimately, you require liquidity. So we think, for us, there is this sort of dichotomy that comes, that some clients are heading towards self-sufficiency. They'll build an income-generating portfolio to deliver that. Some clients are possibly heading towards insurance, and they may use credit to hedge the pricing. They may use other instruments to hedge the pricing. Ultimately, they may require liquidity at some point in time to achieve that. So I think thinking through the journey tends to sort of define what assets people are using now. So if you're going to be around for the long term, you want income from your assets, you will have a bigger credit portfolio. It possibly may have more private elements in it, which are less saleable. They are driving income to meet your pensioners over time, and that's your self-sufficient place. If, as Steve mentioned, you're going through a series of purchases of insurance contracts to de-risk over time, you might need more liquidity. So you want more liquid credit forms to match the pricing as you go. You want more liquid assets available to support those insurance transactions, because you don't want to lose value by having to hit heavy transaction costs. So I think the fundamental driver is, what are you trying to get towards, and build your portfolio to deal with that. Credit definitely has a role in it. The type of credit will differ depending on where you're headed.
Credit, as you say, has a role. It is, in our view, part of pretty much any de-risking portfolio. It is a hedging asset. The extent to which you can you can stomach illiquidity then drives the type of credit you might therefore include in your respective de-risking portfolio. I think that's very, that's certainly how we've been thinking about it, and it's great to hear we're on the same page. No conversation on investing is complete nowadays without reference to ESG. We've seen the first issuance of a green gilt in the UK, with another one on its way. Market appetite was, to put it mildly, huge, but we saw very little appetite from UK pension funds to participate given the premium associated with the issuance. So Tim, what are your views on this and ESG more broadly when it comes to LDI?
So we're very much focusing on the E, I think, within the ESG here as much as anything. Sort of, we are undoubtedly, the world is on a path to decarbonisation. And I think trustees are now looking at their assets and thinking, those assets are either part of the solution or they should be doing something to solve the problem. I mean, the green gilt to me is financing green projects. It is therefore on the path to solving the problem. I think whether it's sort of you're solving the problem through engaging with companies or financing slightly higher costs on green gilts, I think you can see that as part of potentially a trustee strategy. But you're right, trustees have probably waited to see what happens with green gilts. There has been a small premium for that green gilt that you've had to pay, but you could equally say, well, that's part of the longer term sustainability of our investments by making sure we are investing towards a green economy, which is part of almost a net zero strategy. You can see how it could fit in with that. You can see how it's justifying that. But I don't think it's unusual as well for trustees to look and see, with something like a green gilt, how the first one goes. I think that general theme, though, across all assets is the assets, again, part of the solution. But if we just invested in I don't know, low carbon green assets at this stage, that wouldn't solve the problem of decarbonisation. So trustees need to get this balance right between the assets that are green, good, decarbonised, whatever else, and those that are going to drive better outcomes from decarbonisation in the future. And green guilt for me was one of those. That's the way I see it.
As you say, Tim, yeah, I think I'd agree with your observations there, particularly the first issuance. I think many trustees will, and you know, pension funds will be watching, observing, learning, and still, you know, at the current time, still going through their own kind of belief and objective setting processes around this. And I suspect we will see a much greater take up in future from pension funds for green gilt, but it will be something to watch as it evolves. Steve, I know the Boots trustees have been taking their ESG responsibilities seriously and have been thinking more about ESG from a broader asset class perspective. So given this, and feel free to drift broader than just LDI, I was interested to kind of ask you about what your key takeaways have been from your recent discussions and debate around ESG. And most importantly, is there anything you might point to as having really impacted the debate with the trustees on ESG?
Yeah, I think I'm probably going to echo a lot of what Tim's already said. I mean, you're right, we are looking particularly big focus on the E of ESG at the minute, not least with the new reporting requirements that, you know, that we have to comply with. But it's sort of an interesting perspective. The trustees are very keen to, you know, use the money in the pension scheme, you know, to push this forward. Albeit, you know, they mustn't forget their primary responsibility is to pay pensions. So clearly that's still very much at the top of their mind. But what's interesting, as Tim mentioned, is the two sort of approaches to deal with it, either using and investing in, you know, green tech companies that are just starting out that will help develop the solutions to, you know, move to a low carbon economy. And the other view, which we mustn't lose sight of, is engaging with, you know, existing blue chip companies and changing their behavior or trying to influence their behavior through, you know, through good stewardship to make sure that they are developed and adapted for a low carbon economy. So it's trying to do the two approaches, really, I think is really helpful, and not just think that ESG means investing in those new startups or those green focus companies. It's also about changing behavior.
Yeah, that's certainly a subject very close to our hearts again here at LGIM, as you know, with our significant focus on strong stewardship as one such example, I think, of what you're describing there.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff, we have to compliment LGIM on their approach to engagement. It's great.
Thank you, Tim. That's very kind. Gents, I think it's time for me to start thinking about wrapping up this session. But before I do, I can't help but ask you both for a very short response on a question which has been asked of consultants and LDI providers over the last 20 years. And I suspect very few have at any given point in time managed to nail it without delivering a sufficiently woolly answer to avoid being wrong on it. And the question is, where is the gilt yield curve in 3 years from here? Tim, as the consultant, you get to go first on this. And in particular, I guess the angle here is for clients who haven't hedged and been trying to rate for the right time, what do you think?
I mean, our fixed income gurus would sit there and sort of analyze all the data and come back with a view and would say probably things are not going to be substantially different from where they are. But ultimately, we're making estimates and guesses and stuff around these things. It has been phenomenally hard to call interest rates historically. It doesn't look like it's getting any easier with supply chain crisis, sort of expansion of monetary policy now needed to be sent into reverse, sort of inflation volatility, everything else kicking around. So I think in some ways, the whole premise of de-risking has been removing unrewarded risk. I think removing unrewarded risk and probably not taking great interest rate bets or inflation bets is still our path. You look for some sort of view around where there might be benefits, but not a great view. who knows is ultimately my answer, I think, Amadou. Yeah.
So, Tim, I'm going to interpret that as hedge if it's the right thing to do from a strategic perspective, and don't try and time the market because there are a lot of risks out there. Is that a fair summary, or have I been a bit too liberal there?
As always, take rewarded risk. Invest where you think you are going to make returns. Bond markets, interest rates, inflation make movements great for sort of some managers, but trustees, I don't think it's the right thing for them to be doing. Move that risk, it's unrewarded. Yeah.
Steve, what do you think about the advice from the consultant over here? Would you be taking that advice?
I mean, I think it's fair. I think inflation is the interesting one. I think we're obviously seeing inflation spiking a little bit at the minute, and whether that's sort of a short-term supply issue or if that is going to be more persistent over time. So, you know, there's definitely risks out there. And I agree with Tim, you know, if we can take the unrewarded risks off the table and, you know, we can look to get our returns where it's more available, I think that's the right thing to do. I think I've heard over so many years, as you said, to introduce this piece, is that interest rates can only go one way, can't they? And history has typically proved them right, but not in the way they were expecting.
Thanks, Steve. So I think you're taking Tim's advice there. So that's great to hear. I'm gonna try and I think do another session in a few years' time, and we can reflect on how right or wrong we've been. Although I suspect we haven't given a really firm direction on rates for our listeners. But look, thank you both for a really fantastic discussion. Like I said, I suggest we meet up again. I'm really pleased that you were able to join me to break my duck on podcasts, and fingers crossed, yeah, we can meet up again in another 20 years to look back on another milestone. Fingers crossed we are much closer to our respective retirement dates at that point. But gentlemen, thank you so much. And thank you to all our listeners.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating, or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous, on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only, and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, LGIM.com.